Welcome to the Business Isn't Usual podcast by Rightway. I'm your host, Stuart Wilkinson. Today, the conversation is all around e-commerce. We know moving to online has been the big trend in the last 12 months, and there's a bunch of businesses that would have just embraced this e-commerce strategy and a lot of people thinking about how they move into the e-commerce space. But today's conversation is about what could you do better? How do you start and what do you need to consider when looking at your e-commerce strategy? Our guest and speaker is Hugo Venter. Hugo is a senior transformation partner at Engaging Partners in Auckland. He's a marketing professional with a diverse background in digital and traditional media. His resumes include complex CRM and CMS projects for organizations such as the World Bank Group, MSC Cruises, and First National Bank. He has overseen e-commerce deployment in businesses of various size and scales, and has worked with Shopify in support of their largest merchants on Shopify Plus platform. So he'll be an ideal expert for us to dig into today. We've also, at Rightway, we're partnering with Engaging Partners to run a webinar, which is on the 10th of March, on how to squeeze the maximum profitability out of e-commerce. So if you're looking for ideas and tips on how to ensure your e-commerce platform is set up to optimal profitability, I'll put the link to that webinar down below and make sure you sign up to that as well. But also, for any other information on Rightway, go to www.rightway.co.nz. We're also on all the social media platforms, but hope you enjoy this conversation. Hugo, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
So Hugo, when we were sort of briefing for our today's conversation, you know, we were looking at, I guess, e-commerce and I guess that thought on there's a lot of people that have had to make that shift and adapt and, as you said, that wonderful word, pivot. But I guess there's a sense of a couple of things here, though, before we get into some sort of practical steps of there is a change. You know, some buying trends have been accelerated. There's plenty of press around that. So what is this, you know, this movement to online and this rush to movement online? What is that? Is it what's been done well, but also what's been forgotten through that process?
Yeah, it's a really interesting thing. And if you look at the entire gamut of how businesses have had to change, it goes everything from your little coffee shop on the corner to car dealers who have had to pivot the entire shopper journey and model that they'd established for the longest time. And some businesses have done really well and other businesses have done not so well in that they've completely forgotten who their customer is and just shoehorned an e-commerce portion of their business, you know, into the mix, but they didn't think about the user journey and their customer journey. So they may have alienated and lost a lot of their business just because it was such a jarring shift for everybody when we were already going through quite a bit of change.
Yeah. So I guess there would have been that bunch of uptake, you know, especially with lockdowns and the disruption that's meant to accessibility of your customers that, as you said, we've shoehorned people in just because of necessity for a business. But you talked about that client journey. Since then, have you seen people actually go, well, this is now a proper strategy and actually invest, or they just kind of thought that's it and I'll just carry on as usual? What are the mistakes that people have made when you think about that you know, you talk about user journey? What does that mean for people?
Yeah, so again, really interesting. A lot of people and businesses may have adopted e-commerce as part of their strategy prior to or during lockdown. They thought about it, they implemented it, and they rolled it out, and then forgot about it. Yeah. So it was there to serve a purpose, and then things got quote unquote back to normal, which in reality it probably never will. And they kind of just left it, and then backtracked to last week when we went into snap lockdown again. They had to kind of dust off the cobwebs and think, oh goodness, we do actually have this e-commerce platform that we've kind of forgotten about again. Meanwhile, are their customers still there to take advantage of it? We don't know. Other businesses saw the value in the e-commerce and they've maybe made a fundamental change in their business model to add equal weighting to their in-store versus their online interaction with their customers.
And I think that the one thing I think we wanted to talk about in this podcast is that, you know, there's obviously the obvious channels and retailers that will go, hey, I've got a product and it makes sense to e-commerce. But there was that example you had of the cafe where you live, Hugo, that how they actually really adopted this to, one, better serve their customers. I think that was it. So it's not just about product-based clients. There's also those non-traditional e-commerce industry are making great strides when doing this well, aren't they?
Yeah. The cafe example is really good because if you think about the business model for a cafe, it really is walk in, place your order, wait for it, and walk out. So you wouldn't necessarily think about that as a e-commerce driven business. But when all the restrictions were announced that came with level three and social distancing and click and collect, etc. The cafe had to realize that there is an opportunity for them to still continue doing business, but they had to change the way they did business.
Yeah.
And that was a bit of an education on the part of them as business owners, but also educating their customers that there's a new way of interacting with them.
So What in that example that we talked about and you're sharing there, Hugo, what's the difference between the, you know, there's that, as we said, the necessity of getting things online, you know, actually just get something functional. What's the difference between that and actually doing it really, really well? What are the other surrounding parts to this, you know, e-commerce strategy that people really need to think about rather than just, I've got some products in my store, I've put them online, Bob's your uncle. What else has to be really considered when thinking about doing this really, really well?
Yeah, that's a great question. One thing that businesses need to realize if they've never participated in online is that if they suddenly shift to offering their products online, they're competing in an established market where their competitors have already been doing this for a long time. So what is going to distinguish them from the competition? And then how are their customers going to find them in this mix of, quite frankly, a new world that they're discovering because they may have been shopping at a certain place for a long time because that's what they knew and they were comfortable with. But now they're going online and it's like, well, there's actually 10 other people that sell the same thing for maybe less money even. So when it comes to that shift online, businesses need to think about a minimum viable product for their e-commerce and that what's going to deliver their core objective of getting their customers to purchase online, but at the same time thinking about their business identity, their customer journey, who their customer is. And maybe some businesses don't have all those insights, so it would pay to engage an agency or a shopper marketer agency to define those journeys for them. But really, most businesses have an idea of who their customer is.
Yep.
And it's really important to think about that when making that jump online.
Because I think when you talked about that example, it's a very different world, as you said. Like, you're going from, hey, I've got a premium retail location, I'm basing it on foot traffic and the demographic I'm basing my store in, to I'm now in a global marketplace and where I am is irrelevant. And I think one of the things you said, Hugo, in this prep for this podcast is that people have got to think that their buyers maybe online might be different to their buyers that they have in store. So do you want to just talk about the thought process that people have to think about when, hey, yes, it's the same products and the same services potentially, but it is potentially a different buyer that might be purchasing your products and services?
Yeah, so the number one thing to consider when thinking about your online buyer is that they expect things straight away. You want to see the product now, you want to check out, you want to pay for it, and you want to get an order notification and you want that delivered within 2 days. That's unfortunately the kind of always on culture we've cultivated and that instant gratification culture as well. A great example that we spoke about would be high street retail, where you've got an established client base who are used to shopping in store. They like going to the cosmetics counter and interacting with the consultant behind the counter on their creams and their foundations and their potions and powders. Likewise, they may rely on that interaction with the beauty buyers or the fashion buyers about the handbag or the watch that they want to buy. Now you shift online, and especially with an older demographic, they may already be online because they're interacting through social media with their family and their grandkids and extended family, but now they're also being introduced to e-commerce, which is scary, but at the same time, you need to try and create your online journey to slot in with that buying behavior in a seamless way as possible.
Yeah.
So a great example would be having online consultations you can book with that person at the beauty counter that you may have been dealing with for the longest time, or just to keep that interaction alive, because else you're going to be another faceless company that's going to show up in Google Shopping and people are going to go for the cheapest option first.
And I think, like, I'm just thinking of an example of this is, my partner, she's bought off, I think it's Boohoo in the UK. And one of the things I think they do really well is as you buy more, they start to understand your sizing really well. So they then suggest the sizing thing, which is, again, it's such a simple thing, but what is the benefit of going in store is you can try something on and you know then, hey, look, there's less chances of returning it. I know it's going to fit right. So I guess the barrier for online for shopping on clothes is, well, is it going to fit? So that they've obviously really considered this and thought about it and obviously put some tech behind it to make that simpler. But it's thinking through what is the barriers of online versus in store? What is it that I, how can I replicate that consultation, sizing, whatever it might be? Because if you miss those key buying steps, you're not going to be successful online, are you?
Yeah, there's a fashion retailer who I worked with last year, international one, who, to that point, I hate buying clothes online because I need the tactile experience of trying something on and does a shirt fit right? Because it may be the right size, but it may have been cut in a different way. Yes. So it's too narrow, or the sleeves are too short, or the shoulder's not broad enough, but it's still a size whatever I wear. So this particular retailer started doing a deep analysis on their returns data to start building up that pattern. So if I continually bought a size, let's say a medium of any particular type of garment, but I kept on returning them and the return reason was too small, they started building machine learning into their e-commerce experience where they would say, oh, we know that you generally buy this, but we also know that it doesn't quite fit. So maybe have a look at this one instead.
Yes.
So that way you're building up kind of a profile of your customer, but you're also building rapport with your customer because you're taking a pain point out of the journey for them. Because you don't want to buy something online and then return it because it doesn't fit. You want to buy something and keep it because that's why you bought it, right?
Yeah.
So that was a great example of taking something that's very difficult to do through an online medium and actually building it into their e-commerce platform very successfully.
Yeah. I guess, and you know, thinking of, you know, our audience that we have on a podcast, a lot of, you know, it's smaller to medium-sized business owners and stuff, Hugo, and I guess some of these examples we're talking about are big companies that have got big infrastructure, big investment behind them, technology people, all that sort of stuff. You know, so how, I guess, moving online to what is now a global platform, you know, I use Boohoo as an example. So if I'm a New Zealand clothing store, I'm now competing in that market rather than just Auckland, Wellington, Tauranga, or wherever. So that is, an intimidating proposition in going, well, hey, look, how the heck am I going to do that? Because I know I've got to make sure people are comfortable buying online. So what is your advice to those smaller retailers and stuff when they start to take this step of that intimidation factor of, gosh, I'm now against the big boys in the world. So how do, and you talked about your differential point versus other stores, but what's your advice to those people of taking that step online and not being scared and actually having a plan to compete in some ways with those people?
Yeah, that's such a careful consideration. When you jump online for the first time, it's not like you're jumping into a very big pool full of swimmers, right? It is because the internet is vast and everybody's already there. But stick to your knitting and do what you're good at, right? So you don't have to compete against everybody. You just have to compete in the market you're in. A big mistake store owners often make when they jump online for the first time is spend a lot of money on Google Ads and Facebook marketing, but they do it in such a broad sense that they're targeting completely irrelevant customers.
Right.
So if you know that you can only service customers in major centers, do your Facebook targeting very shrewdly around those centers so you can maximize your ad spend. If you know you're not shipping to Australia, don't advertise to them. Yeah. Don't make yourself known to them. Don't be aware of that market. Don't worry about them because you want to focus on where you can deliver your product or service. And once you get over that mental barrier of, oh my goodness, I'm competing against the big brands out there, you'll find that it actually isn't all that difficult. And then it's just really about defining and understanding what your buyer journey is like and what your own tech competence is, because that's another big consideration that people often don't make.
And we're going to talk about that in a bit, as talk about your competence. But I think in some ways, you know, I know, Hugo, you've got a lot of experience with Shopify. Is the technology, it doesn't matter what systems you use, it's becoming easier and easier to get set up quickly, get something online. So if people are going to something like a Shopify website and going, okay, cool, this is, I can do some stuff myself, what is the things they need to really need to think about? Because it, you know, it is a system that's designed, that's got good user interface, it's got good, it is easy to use, but you know, if this is going to be a serious channel, you need to invest in your business like anything else. So what is your advice when people who are starting to set up and go, I'll just play around a little bit and I'll do something myself, versus actually getting some real expertise and having a plan around it? What's the sort of pitfalls and things people need to consider when actually choosing what platform they use and then starting to set up that process?
There's that old saying, time is money, right? Yeah. So even saying, oh, I'll give this a go and see if it works, you need to consider that every minute you spend faffing around on an e-commerce store that's not generating revenue for you is money wasted, where you could have been spending that time on something else. Yeah, it's easy to jump online, but it's also easy to just waste time. I liken it to gym memberships, because the worst thing than not going to the gym is wasting time at the gym, right? Yep. And then you end up paying a gym membership, but you don't use it.
Yeah,
e-commerce isn't free. Whether you're doing it through Shopify or WooCommerce or Wix or whatever of the myriad platforms available you choose, it's still a capex for your business,
yes,
because you have to pay for the service, you have to pay for the time, there's resource investment. So when you decide to make this jump, you need to, again, know your own tech ability and how comfortable you are managing these things. But you also need to bear in mind that you're going to have to allocate time in a day to process orders. You have to make sure that the site's up and running. You need to be able to field service queries from your customers just saying, oh, I'm trying to buy this shirt, but it's not allowing me to check out. What do you do? How do you troubleshoot a tech problem if you were barely able to launch the store online?
Yes.
So it's easy to do that jump online, but it would be really prudent for anybody to have some kind of support that they could call on if things went awry, because then you're putting your brand out there. You've got a reputation you may have built up over many tens of years, and by putting a poor e-commerce implementation out there, you're just going to do damage to the brand.
Yeah.
And it's easier to destroy a brand than to build one, right? So
it's
going to take a while to repair that kind of damage.
And I think to that point is that, you know, for business owners, you know, they might have a, you know, small to medium-sized retail or whatever service-based firm that want to move in e-commerce. You know, we've had episodes on this, but it's a discussion we're often with our clients, is how they move themselves out of the business, how they put time in. So something like e-commerce, as you said, Hugo, it is a new strategy for your business, something that needs well thought through. So for you to think you can then suddenly add extra hours in the day, which you probably don't have already, to suddenly make it and then make it successful, is a bit foolish. Like, if you're going to invest, you need to invest properly. And I thought that point around how you deal with returns, it comes back to that buyer journey point of view, doesn't it? Because it's easy when, oh, cool, I'm dealing with someone in person and I've trained my staff on how that works, versus an online chat, and that's, you know, or other means that you're communicating, which is completely different to what you're normally used to. And also you're selling that product in person, whereas you've now got to ship it and put it in within 2 days, because that's what everyone expects. And there was plenty of press about places like The Warehouse who couldn't do that through the pandemic. There is a lot of thought here, rather than just, hey, my website's up and that's done. And I think the one thing you talked about, we talked about the supermarket's experiences, and I talked about my own personal buying trend that's changed, that I've now ordered all my supermarket online. But as you pointed out, Hugo, that's got to be very, the supermarkets have had to be very considered about that, because supermarkets are designed for the upsell, and now online doesn't necessarily provide that. So do you want to talk about that again, going back to that buyer behavior conversation we were having, of just because you're online, it actually might be a completely different buying habit and behavior that a client goes through, because you can't upsell them to this, or you can't have that conversation about that, and how do people think about that?
Yeah, the supermarket's a great example, because you are 100% correct in that it's designed for the upsell. So you've got temptation aisles, and you've got aisle ends, and you've got dump bins with $79 chocolates, whatever, cents chocolates. So all of those things, you go to the supermarket with a shopping list, but invariably you end up spending double what you had planned to if you're not a very shrewd shopper, because there's all these temptations that you pick up along the way. Transferring that into online is really difficult, because then you end end up with tyranny of choice, because in a supermarket, you're captive. You're there. You are gated in that you have a pathway to follow through the store.
It's very visual
in,
as well.
One way out.
Yeah.
It's very unlikely that somebody is going to quote unquote abandon cart in a new world.
You don't see shopping trolleys through it. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. There's those shopping trolleys just stood with people going, too hard. Where online, it is a reality.
Yeah.
You can shop online and you can upsell to a certain point, but it's also a very fine balance in how you do that. Because yes, you want to promote more products and services to your customers, and especially like complementary products, like things that go together. Mm. But you have to be so careful when doing that, because you end up with abandoned carts. So yes, upsell by all means, but when shopping online, if something gets too hard, you just close the browser window and go, nah, can't deal with it. And then you just lose the customer. And that's where online retailers like Apple, for instance, when they sell their products online, they're so clever, because they don't bombard you with extra options. They just, you're there to buy something, you buy it and you're gone. Whereas on the completely other side of the spectrum, if you've ever browsed AliExpress for anything, it's just like you're looking at a kaleidoscope of options, and it just becomes very bewildering. Mm. And I think that's the key message there, is that you don't want to frustrate and bewilder your customer, because then they're just going to leave and go somewhere else that gives them a better online experience.
And I think I'll put a caveat, I'm a big Apple fan. But I find their online experiences, based in New Zealand, I find incredible, because I think what I think I appreciate about that experience is not the online part of it, but it's the delivery part of it. Like, and if anyone's ordered from Apple, like, the communication's excellent. You get a text message on the day it's going to arrive. It's free shipping. It often arrives within 24 hours, and it's coming from Sydney most of the time, unless sometimes you have to get stuff from where they're based in China. But it's the communication and the confidence that gives you of how they communicate, I feel, with you, that actually makes it a really buying experience. Not just the click part, and the website, and do you find that, with the freighting and the supply chain that people have to put behind their stores to make this really seamless? And I know there's really some good suppliers that help with this sort of, but do people forget that part often? Because the reality is, the buying experience, if it's in store, it's when you've tried something, whatever, but it's when you walked out with the bag and I'm going home. So if you think the website's the final part, it's not, isn't it? Because it's not in your house. So do many people forget the experience post hitting the checkout button?
100%. Shopping in store is transactional, in that you see something, you get it, you give money, and you walk away with it.
And gratification from that as well.
Instant gratification. Yeah. Shopping online means that you often have to wait a long period of time for your widget, whatever it is, to be delivered. And that's where that consideration of time comes into launching your online store. Because it's not just me clicking a button, you getting an order, and eventually sending it out to me, right?
Mm.
There is this entire continuous communication journey that you have to cultivate, because you're getting money from somebody without them getting anything like physical in return.
Yep.
And that becomes really sticky, because if you commit to doing 24-hour delivery, for instance, if you can't commit to that, you know that customer's going to jump online on email or phone, or worst case, onto social media. And start asking questions like, where's my order? I ordered this several days ago. I have had no communication from you. This is a topic we used to love to talk to Shopify merchants about as well, because something that's very prominent in Shopify is dropshipping. So you're just a storefront for something that gets mass produced
somewhere else.
Yeah. And unfortunately, you have to manage the comms around that, because you're getting the money for it. And your customer is expecting you to deliver the product. They don't care whether it's made somewhere else. So that communication exercise is so important. And then also, there has to be a surprise and delight element to online shopping as well. It's simply not enough to throw the product in a box, send it off using courier post, and expect your customer to be super thrilled when they get it. They'll be expecting the bare minimum, right? They want the thing they bought. But in in the businesses I've worked in, for instance, where we had a large e-commerce component, you want to go that extra mile because you don't have that friendly smiling face at checkout that you have in store. Yeah. So you have to present that friendly smiling face when they open the box. Mm. And again, Apple is excellent at this. Because Steve Jobs famously said many years ago that the buyer journey the user experience starts from the moment they open the box, which is why Apple has always invested quite a lot of money in their packaging and defining, you know, what that looks like and the way you unwrap things and the steps you go through to get to the product. Likewise, it doesn't take a lot for you to do that with your online purchases. Like wrap it in a nice piece of paper, put a handwritten note in there if you've got the capacity. But again, capacity is key, because if you don't have time to manage orders, you're not going to have time to manage the customer satisfaction part of it.
Yeah. And I must admit, I just, when you said that, Hugo, I was thinking, my daughter's 19 months, so there's a couple of New Zealand suppliers of baby wear and stuff that my wife, she buys from, and they do this really well, is that it'll be really nicely wrapped. There's been handwritten cards, and the minute you open it, it brings a smile to your face, because you're like, they've gone over and above. So you're right. It isn't just, you know, that it's those, although I call it in business, the one percenters, and those one percenters can make a big difference on one, if they're going to come back for a customer, or if they're going to recommend you and say, hey, you know, check this site out, it's awesome. So it's a much more well thought process of like, is my website up to, it's all those little things and that buyer journey you want that customer to go through to really think about it. Now, just going into it, I guess on one of the sections we want to talk about is, you know, Hugo, we mentioned in prep, there's a lot of clients and a lot of business owners who have, you know, got online in the last 12, 18 months because of COVID. They've had to, as you say, adapt. They've had to, from a transactional basis, get online. So what is your advice? What are some practical steps? As I've been online maybe 12, 18 months, and that there'll be different rates of people and adoption of how far they've gone with their e-commerce. But what is your advice? Because I imagine there's, like we said earlier, a lot of people have got online probably in out of necessity. So they've not necessarily had the time to think through what we've talked about today. So if I've got something in place already, what's some practical steps that I can go through to really analyze, is my e-commerce, is it doing what it should be doing, or could it do better? What some steps that business owners could maybe take to review where their e-commerce is at?
Yeah, one of my favorite recommendations is to ring fence your e-commerce. So if your e-commerce is costing you X amount of money a month to maintain, pay for services, software as a service, hosting, whatever it is, if your e-commerce is doing anything over that, take that portion of over that, whatever is left over after you've taken the CapEx out, and reinvest it back into e-commerce. Because it should be seen as a separate part of the business almost. Yeah. If your online or if your retail store, your brick and mortar, is performing well, or your other sales channels are doing really well, and the e-commerce is supplementing all of that, reinvest back into it. Analyze the data. If you went online at the towards the end of first lockdown, you hopefully would have integrated something like Google Analytics.
Yeah.
Or if you're on Shopify, Shopify Analytics is really good baked in. Look at the data. Look at where potential pinch points are. They do a great job of mapping the funnel of the websites. Yes. So see where your exit points are. Analyze those pages. Look at why, as a consumer, you would leave the site at that point, because store owners will often put something online, but they won't go through the journey that a customer would go through. They would spend a lot of time in the back end finessing things, making sure the prices and the products are right. But how often do they rigorously test their actual online store?
Yeah.
So go through the journey as a customer and see what's happened. And if you see that there are pain points and you don't know how to address them, find somebody who can help you.
Yeah.
Because if you've just got something that's kind of sat there and it's stagnating, maybe just ticking by, there's an opportunity there to grow it, because it is generating revenue for the business. So reinvest the time, reinvest the money, get an expert if you need to, but certainly analyze the data, because that's how all decisions should be made. You need to look at what your buyer behaviors have been since you launched the online store.
Completely agree. And I know, and I don't want to lead into, there's a webinar that we're co-hosting, not me, but Isaac, one of our business partners with yourself, Hugo, and Sonia from Engaging Partners. and it's all about profitability and all that sort of stuff around e-commerce. And but one of the things I know with the Shopify integration.
We did it all the time.
I know, they're very close, isn't it? Shopify integration with Xero is it's got a very good integration with Xero that means then if you want to, from a profit and loss point of view, understand what's my sales from online versus my store, it's actually quite easy to set up through what they call the group code and all that sort of stuff within Xero. So, you know, simple steps can give you quite good visibility, as you said, Hugo, through, you know, technology nowadays to get good ideas of how things are performing, what's my cost, and understand that. What other areas, because I think that's a really interesting point about separate business unit and really understanding that as a separate thing, but you've also touched on there a little bit of your investment in e-commerce compared to store, because yep, I'm going to invest in it because it's the only way I can do business and now I've forgotten about it. But how do people start to think going, hey, I've got something in place here. What should my investment be? How do people start to think forward and go, well, what's too much in some ways to invest in my e-commerce store?
I mean, it comes back to profitability, really.
Yep.
I mean, an e-commerce store is no different to a brick and mortar store in that in a brick and mortar store, you pay for floor space, you pay utilities, you pay staff, you have your products on display, et cetera, et cetera. A e-commerce store is no different. You pay for hosting, you pay for ways to generate traffic into the store, you have to pay yourself in time to manage the online store. So you have to think about them business 101 in the same way, in that you do have to have profitability.
Yeah.
And the only way you can do that is to really understand what the cost of your e-commerce is to your business.
Yeah.
Because Shopify, by default, you can have the cost price of a product and the price you're selling it at. So within Shopify reports, you can very easily generate a profit margin for the product. But is that profit margin really accurate?
Yep.
Like, have you taken into account the maybe $29 or more you're spending each month on Shopify? Does it take into account the $100 per boosted post you do on social media? Does it take into account the 4 hours a week you have to spend picking and packing orders?
Yep.
And all of those things just need to be considered when it comes to analyzing whether or not your e-commerce is profitable for your business.
Yeah, and I think going back to that Xero situation, I think that's when, if you get your Xero set up really well, is you can do that. You can, hey, look, what's my GP and my products, and have that set up quite well in Xero. But also, if I've got operating costs that are for the brick and mortar, but I've got ones that are specifically for my e-commerce, so I can break those out and say, well, these are, you know, because often we see there's so many clients that they'll have sales, by the way, in Xero, and that's their only line code in their P&L, and so that's giving them no insight. Same as if you go down, is if you're throwing all your marketing costs for your whole business into one pool, it's very hard then to understand, well, is my e-commerce making money or not? You're not really segmenting, but you can do that really simply in Xero to actually understand that $1,000 has gone for my e-commerce, that $1,000 for my retail, and start to understanding it's a business unit. So there's obviously going to be a bunch of people that are now thinking, I've got to get online. I've got to start thinking of an e-commerce strategy. When I say that word e-commerce strategy, what should people think about, Hugo? Like we've talked about, don't just put a website up and think that's Bob's your uncle. Like, where's a really good starting point before you get into, you know, the website and stuff? Where do I start?
Yeah. So again, I love saying stick to your knitting.
Yeah.
Because every business has a reason for being, and they've got a why, and you need to know what your why is. Mm. Then look at your customer and see how your why services their need, because they're only buying from you because they have a need, right? Mm. Once you have an understanding of that, you've started formulating a picture of what your buyer personas are. Think about how your buyers are going to interact with you online and what you want to deliver, because that will often dictate a lot of things. If you're very transactional and sell a simple range of products, and you know that your customer will likely be going to the store, putting in a cart, checking out and getting the product and be happy with that, then that's fine. You can very easily launch a very simple online store to serve that need. Mm. You've got that one-to-one line of communication with them. That's fine. If you've got a more complicated type of business, or a business that traditionally had a lot of touch points, you do have to invest time in mapping out a buyer journey and thinking about how the transition from brick and mortar or shopping in a store or a stall at a at a market changes when you push your customer online, because you don't have that face-to-face. So how are you going to continue delighting the customer? How are you going to live according to your business's own values and the reason, the why? And what is going to keep your customer coming back to you to fulfill their need, as opposed to going to your competition who've been doing this a long time? Obviously, analyzing the competition is a good thing. You have to do a bit of competitive intelligence. But you also don't want to go and create copies, because that's just poor sportsmanship.
Exactly. But interesting, you talked there about, like, even if you've got a quite transactional product, that's more of, you know, there's not much, you know, it's a short buying window or consideration from the customer. I guess in those, some example though, there's probably an immediacy that might come with more of the in-person transaction potentially for that product. So would it be safe to say, Hugo, if yes, it might be a simple checkout process, but where you might want to, which we talked about earlier, might more have to put some time is more on, hey, my freight and my supply chain has got to back that up, because if it's not 24 hours, they'll just go to the store, because it's more of a transactional thing. Whereas it's more considered, I might wait 48 hours. Is it those sort of things that people have really got to think about, what, of online then delivery, which I know we've talked about before, but and just earlier, but it is a full mapping of this whole process. It's got to be really thought through, doesn't it?
Yeah, it also depends on where you store your product.
Yes.
If you're dispatching from home or from a store or a building or something that you control it. You can commit to, we will have your order picked, packed, and ready for pickup within 24 hours. Then the courier company, hopefully you've got some kind of SLA with them, but we know the courier companies in New Zealand can be hit and miss sometimes. So commit to a general time frame that you know is reasonable. And again, you can, if you've been doing this for a year or so, you can kind of gauge what a reasonable delivery window is. But at the same time, if you're only now going to jump online, have a talk to the courier company you're going to be contracting and ask them if they can commit to an SLA. It gets a bit more complicated when you're using a 3PL or a warehouse to store and pack and ship and dispatch your products.
Yes.
Because where now you could fax or phone, goodness, if people even use faxes, but you could fax, phone, or email an order through to them and they will get it out to your customer, no problem. Now, if you're going to introduce an e-commerce component to it, how are those systems going to talk to each other?
Yeah.
That can be really complex. And I've done a couple of these integrations in my time and they can be really tricky. If they work really well, they work really well, and that's excellent. But you also need to know what happens if that chain breaks down.
Yeah.
Like, can you download the orders and email them to the warehouse company to dispatch on your behalf? So yeah, it's not as simple as just saying push your product online and see what happens. There are so many steps in between. We just this morning had a look at a map that we were working on for a client, and our initial kind of mind map of it was 10 steps. And then below that, we've got the actual mapped out mind map, which now looks like the plan for a nuclear power plant in complexity, because there's so many things that come out of the discovery process that you wouldn't have thought about initially. Like the simplest thing that I would say to business owners looking to go online is take a day away. If you've got staff, take a day away with your staff, everybody that's going to support you in this venture, and get everybody's input on what the online journey should be. Because if you're in isolation sitting there thinking, okay, I'm going to put the store online and then Mary in the back office is going to process payments and book the courier. Jacob is going to pack the packages and wrap them up and put them at the door. And then the courier is going to pick them up magically and it's going to be the end of it. It's never going to be that simple. So make it consultative, because then everybody will feel part of the journey, but you'll also get many more points of reference for where the whole process could fall over.
And, you know, and the more staff you involve, you know, all your staff will be involved with your current customers in different ways and know what they value, what they like, and things that have worked and not worked in your in-house or in-store experience or however you conduct your current business. So all that input is going to give you really rounded views on, to your point, a consultative process, Hugo, which will really get a much rounded view of what should be done. We talked earlier, Hugo, about technical competence, and, you know, it's part of the starting point, a really honest conversation about technical competence of the people, and that's of your team, you, because like you said, depending on where you go, well, from a website point of view, but also the process of how you actually get your products to the end user. There's a lot of technical expertise which you might not have been dealt with, whether that's from freight to the online technical space. Do you want to just talk about how people should really think about that?
Yeah, one of the first examples that comes to mind is customer service. So technical competence in customer service, maybe you've got a social media person that responds to the queries that you get on social media. Let's assume that the business in this example is a Auckland-based retailer who predominantly services Auckland City and surrounding suburbs. Very seldom they'll get somebody from further afield coming into the city to buy a product from them, but predominantly they're within a X kilometer radius. So that's their primary customer base. Now they decide to go online and they're opening themselves up to all of New Zealand.
Yep.
Their social media person may have been capable of dealing with the one or two queries they got online because of a potential product defect or finding out if a product's available in store so that I can go and pick it up. Now you've opened up to all of New Zealand. You're going to get people bombarding you with stock availability questions. If you're starting to ship online, they're going to say, where's my order? They may have got something that was broken. They're going to start complaining about customer service. They're going to start complaining about no feedback. They're going to start complaining about the website being down. And then it becomes this great big fire that this lone person was maybe capable of dealing with in isolation if they were just dealing with their local suburbs. All of a sudden, they're dealing with a cacophony of voices shouting at them. This is stressful. I've been in situations where businesses have made that shift from a very traditional way of selling to selling online. And it changed the way the business communicated with its customers and also the customer's expectation on how the business communicates with them. Likewise, always come back to the technical aspect of e-commerce. Something will break. And who do you contact if something breaks? Shopify is great. They've got live chat phone support. But oftentimes, the wait times on those can be 40 minutes to an hour or longer. If you go with smaller kind of e-commerce platforms that maybe also offer support, the wait times are going to be even longer because they've got less staff to service you. So what happens if something goes wrong? Are you able to fix a problem or put a workaround in place when the system falls over? And this again is where the consultative approach is really key, because if you've got a store and you've got a number of staff working for you, you may not realize that somebody in your team has technical competence.
Yes.
Just because it was outside of their scope in their current role, they would never have spoken about the fact that maybe they do have a side hustle running Shopify stores, drop shipping t-shirts.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you've uncovered a resource you didn't know you had, which now supports your journey to online. Likewise, somebody may be a really good copywriter, or somebody may be good at graphic design because they studied it at uni, but now they're working in your store because of X or Y reasons. That gives you an opportunity to leverage what you've got in store because you've built up brand capital with them. They know the business, they know the customer, they know the product, and it allows you to more easily shift online because you've got in-house support for those things.
Yep. I guess to wrap up, Hugo, is there any, I guess, what would be your, you know, we've kind of talked about there for different stages of e-commerce journey, but is there any sort of generic sort of top two, three piece of advice that you try and look to clients? Like what would be your final sort of takeaways for anyone that's listening to this podcast?
My first piece of advice is do it. You need to get online.
Yeah.
If you haven't yet done it, start planning it. Don't just jump into it feet first, but start planning it. Because the reality is we're shifting online.
Yeah.
Car dealers are shifting online to online-only dealership models where there's no more dealership you can go to look at a car, which is, to me as a car fanatic, the most abhorrent thing in the world because I want to go into a dealership and get that experience. So the first thing is to do it. The second thing or piece of advice is to do it well. Yes. Look at what the competition is doing. And if you don't have the technical expertise to do it yourself, get help. It may be an expense at the start of the journey, but it will pay for itself in the long run because you're building out another revenue source for your business. And the third piece of advice is that while your e-commerce store is a separate business unit, don't kind of isolated, because e-commerce can very easily work with your brick and mortar.
Yes.
In that you can have a click and collect service, which a lot of retailers have done really well, but find the synergy.
Yes.
You're not just going to abandon your online or your brick and mortar store for your online. A lot of merchants have.
Yeah.
They've people who've closed up shop, moved everything to their garage, and they're still continuing to trade. But you don't always have to be that drastic. So find the harmony in bringing your store into e-commerce or your business into e-commerce, whether it's a widget-based business or a service-based business. There is a way to do it. Just find the harmony.
That's awesome. Well, plenty there, Hugo. And just a reminder that we have, and we'll put the links in the show notes, we've got a webinar coming up with Engaging Partners on the 10th of March. And so if anyone that wants just a deeper understanding of how to move your e-commerce business forward from a profitability point of view, and we've got, I'll put the links in the show notes. But Hugo, great insights, and thanks for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me, Stuart.